Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, nearly 45 years have passed since the first hip replacement surgery was done in the United States. Once a procedure of last resort, it's become one of the top three surgeries of the baby boom generation. An orthopedic surgeon joins us to talk about the latest surgical techniques, which can cut down on recovery time.
But first, if getting to sleep or staying asleep has never been a problem for you, consider yourself lucky. Sleep and sleep remedies are one of the most commonly researched medical problems online, with many websites offering tips and suggestions. If you're one of those looking for advice, our next guest has the answers based on medical research and solid science.
Last week, we spoke with one of the country's top experts on sleep, and today we've got part two of that interview with Dr. Orfeo Buxton, a sleep researcher and neuroscientist. He's assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health and with the Division of Sleep Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Buxton also teaches at Penn State. His recent Q&A on sleep was featured in the New York Times. Welcome back to Take Care, Dr. Buxton. It's great to have you back.
My pleasure.
Not everybody gets the ideal amount of sleep that they would like, and one way of coping with it is using naps. I have always been a napper, and I find 20 minutes in the late afternoon when I'm able to do it just rejuvenates me and gets me all the way till 10 o'clock with good energy. But what's the science behind napping? How valuable is it? And can a person use it to help them stay healthy?
Naps are just delicious. The feeling after a nice short nap or a very long nap in a restful, relaxing place can just be amazing and restorative. It's a cross-cultural issue. I see civilizations across the pond that allow time for siesta and time with family in the afternoon as really quite pleasant. And it can be a firing offense in the U.S. for taking a nap on the job. I know also in the U.S. we have a post-lunch dip if our lunch wasn't the most healthful, and morning caffeine can be starting to wear off, and that's a time when a nap can be a replacement for excess stimulants. The only time we recommend to not take a nap is if people have difficulty sleeping at night, because that lowers sleep pressure at nighttime and can make it harder for somebody with insomnia, say, to get to sleep. If you have no difficulty sleeping at night and are a little bit tired during the day, by all means, a nap is a wonderful thing. It's a chance for reflection and restarting. I often find that problems that I'm wrestling with, if I take a short nap, they're much more obvious in terms of their solution. There was some really fascinating new science on things that happen when we go to sleep and then wake up. And it may explain the quick refreshingness of a nap, although this hasn't been tested in humans. What they showed was that in mice, this was a science paper from just a couple of weeks ago, that the space between cells in our brain, what's called the interstitial space, expands greatly when we fall asleep. And then when we wake up, that space contracts again. And what that does is it pushes out toxins from around our neurons into our ventricles of our brain, essentially flushing our brain of toxins. So there's a lot more work to be done in that area, but it's a newly discovered important function of sleep, literally cleansing our brain. And that's, I think, the sensation after a nap.
In terms of the length of a nap, is there too long when it starts to be problematic when we wake back up and we're not fully functional?
Sure. So I think it's important here to be clear on blame. This is a blame game. So some people eschew naps because it makes them feel really groggy afterwards. I don't think it's the nap that should be blamed. It's the degree of sleep deprivation that came beforehand. So a short nap under 20 minutes or so can be very refreshing and restore performance and mood and other things for several hours afterwards. If you have a night shift or have really been sleep deprived, a 2 or 3 or 4 hour nap is just catching up from a hole dug very deeply. And when you wake up, there can be sleep inertia or this persistence of a sleep-like state upon awakening that can take a long time to wear off. That's the grogginess people sometimes report after nap. And that's much, much worse if one has been chronically sleep-deprived or pulled an all-nighter. So it's not so much that the nap makes us groggy. It's that the nap makes us realize just how sleep-deprived we've been, and maybe we need even more after that.
Dr. Buxton, we do want to get some of your advice and tips on how to get a good night's sleep. So I do not want to run out of time to talk to you about that. But there are just a couple of things that we'd be remiss if we didn't bring up. And because sleep apnea has been in the news more, and I think we should just get your description of how a person would know if they have just normal snoring or sleep apnea. What advice do you give people? And when is it time to go to the doctor if you think that is what is interrupting your sleep?
Many more people snore than actually have sleep disordered breathing or apnea. Sleep disordered breathing results in insufficient oxygen in the blood and throughout the body, and is often because of a constriction of the airway or structural issues that make it harder to get enough oxygen in. When oxygen levels decline or carbon dioxide levels go up, we have a small gasp, a diving reflex it's called, that allows us to take in extra air. But to do that, the brain has an arousal or a lightening of sleep to get that gasp, which is good because we have air. It's bad because we don't have quality sleep. So one way to tell is if there's more than 20 seconds of not breathing during sleep. So a bed partner can check that. Other key signs are having excessive daytime sleepiness, maybe a morning headache, being a bit overweight, although that's not necessary to have sleep disordered breathing, and large tongue or very dry airway the next morning. You can induce a version of sleep apnea quickly by having a bad head cold and being packed with fluids in your nasal passages. That's how the quality of sleep of somebody with sleep apnea is all the time.
Dr. Orfeo Buxton is our guest today. We're talking about sleep. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, Conversation on Health and Wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
I want to ask one more question before we get to your sleep advice and tips. For those people that, for one reason or another, are not getting a good night's sleep, some people do rely on sleeping pills. What is your thought on sleeping pills in terms of being a long-term solution to sleep problems?
Well, the most effective treatments for insomnia are behavioral treatments. And I say that because they last beyond the cessation of treatment. So when you stop taking a pill, your sleep can revert to what it was before. But when you learn to sleep better and instill new behaviors with cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, it can improve sleep, and those effects last for years. So I think the science is very good on that. Those treatments can take 6 to 8 weeks, though, and a real commitment. And sometimes sleeping pills can be useful in the early stages when there may be a little bit of desperation just to get some sleep. It's important not to use Benadryl or alcohol to get to sleep because they inhibit the good restorative aspects of sleep and can lead to other problems. There are numerous sleeping pills that are approved by the FDA, and so if you're having difficulty sleeping, before trying counterproductive strategies like diphenhydramine or alcohol, it'd be important to discuss potential for sleep treatments, starting with cognitive behavioral therapy that may have as a start sleeping pills.
Dr. Buxton, we have probably about 3 minutes to cover tips that you may have on sleeping better. What would you stress?
Well, there's a long list of what's called sleep hygiene, and people hate to talk about that because it's like being admonished by your dentist for flossing. But I wanted to prioritize the three most important ones, and then I can go through a short list. So the first is to make sleep a priority. Many aspects of our health improve when we get enough, and it helps us to exercise and eat better, and just sort of everything will go better if sleep is a priority in our life. Reduce screen time. especially the blue-enriched LED screens that are in all monitors, tablets, computers, and so on, and especially in the hours before bed, because this will disrupt the circadian clock, make us more alert and less likely to go to sleep when we need to. And then the third is to consult your physician for sleep problems that don't go away with changes in lifestyle, and if they seem new or they are persisting. And we can share a link for advice on how to seek treatment and when.
This is just a minor question. So if you wake up in the middle of the night grabbing for your iPad or your iPhone and reading articles on it for about 15 minutes until you feel sleepy again, that's not enough time to have any big effect on your circadian rhythm, right? You just mean the hours before, but in 15, because when I do that and I'm reading my iPad, I'm thinking, this is probably stupid, but if I turn my reading light on and try to read a book, I might wake up my husband. So I do go to the one that's already lit up, but I just didn't know if 15 minutes can really have that much of a bad effect.
I think you'd be surprised and disappointed. The circadian clock is very sensitive to light at night, especially blue and rich light from these devices. So that's more than enough to completely suppress your melatonin. One way to go is to use screen dimmers. So there's one app called F.Lux. I don't think it works on tablets, but it does take the blue out of the light from the screen. And then, of course, you know, dim it as much as possible so that it's the least bright. But light at night is affecting the circadian clock and suppressing melatonin.
So we just have 1 minute left, Dr. Buxton. What's your best advice to us? Summing it all up.
In addition to those top three of prioritizing sleep, reducing screen time before and during bed, and consulting a physician for a new problem or a persistent problem, our tips for healthy sleep include paying off your sleep debt, get back on track, have a healthy sleep amount, try to get up within an hour or two of the same time, work days and weekends, sleep in a cool, dark, and quiet place. If you're having trouble sleeping, minimize naps during the day, but if you're tired, by all means, enjoy a nap. Get as much light as you can during your waking hours so that your circadian clock is synchronized to your local time zone. Minimize drugs that disturb sleep, especially alcohol, nicotine, and excess caffeine. Exercise regularly. That helps sleep be a little more deep. Enjoy a relaxing bedtime routine, including to the exclusion of work in the hours before bed. And associate the bed and bedroom with sleep and sex, not stress.
Dr. Orfeo Buxton, a sleep researcher with a PhD in neuroscience. He's assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health, associate neuroscientist in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and associate professor at Penn State University. His recent Q&A on sleep was featured in the New York Times. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Parts 1 and 2 of our interview with Dr. Buxton are available on the Take Care webpage at WRVO.org, where we have additional information on sleep.
Coming up, why hip replacement surgery can provide a new lease on life, and how to know if you're a good candidate for the procedure. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.